Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Today we are hearing from musicians who have written books about their lives, chronicling the successes and struggles that have shaped their careers. Our last guest this hour is a man who the LA Times called the finest rock songwriter after Dylan and the best electric guitarist since Hendrix. It's Richard Thompson, one of the founders of Fairport Convention, a key band in the folk rock movement of the UK psychedelic scene in the late 60s. He has a new release, but it's not music. It is a memoir. It's called Bee's Wing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975. The book covers the founding of Fairport Convention, some of his loves and his losses, a tragic car wreck, his turning to the Muslim faith, including his pilgrimage to Mecca, and of course music. In fact, the title comes from a Thompson song of the same name. Here's Bee's Wing.
I was 19 when I came to town. They called it the summer of love. They were burning babies, burning flags, the hawks against the doves. I took a job in the steamy, down on Cauldron Street, and I fell in love with a laundry girl who was working next to me. Well, she was a rare thing, fine as a bee's wing, so fine a breath of wind might blow her away. She was a lost child, well, she was running wild. She said, as long as there's no price on love, I'll stay. And you wouldn't want me any other way.
Richard Thompson joined us this past spring to discuss Bee's Wing. He began our conversation by reading the first paragraph of the book.
There is dust, and then there is dust. It's thickest here in my memory. This remotest room of my mind has been shut up for years. The windows shuttered, the furniture covered with dust sheets. Light hasn't penetrated into some of these corners for years. In some cases, it never has. If something is uncomfortable, I shove it in here and forget about it. When was the last time I dared look? I don't want to remember. But now it is time to think back. The arrow is arcing through the air and speeding towards its appointed target. Etc., etc., for another 300 pages.
There you go. So it's just so interesting because you tackle it right at the beginning. There's so much to think about. There's so much to remember. Some of it is pleasant. Some of it is not. What was your process for digging into your memory so that you could write those additional 300 pages?
I realized that my memory is incredibly selective. And, you know, I remember some stuff very clearly and other stuff I don't remember at all. And comparing notes with some of my old colleagues, you know, from the 60s, they remember totally different stuff to me. And there's things that I remember very well, and they haven't got a clue. So it's a very selective process. And I had a lot of fun writing the anecdotal stuff. The hardest thing for me was putting it together chronologically, when I really had to look at some websites and kind of figure out what happened when. That was the hardest part.
The book focuses mainly on the years and the title, but we do learn a little bit about your life as a child. As a kid, you listened to a lot of what your dad listened to, jazz, traditional Scottish tunes. And you write, I liked some of my father's records and disliked others. I seem to have some sort of a critical instinct, even at a young age. What do you remember about that instinct, about what made you like a certain kind of music and versus another?
Yeah, it was almost like a physical reaction. You know, I'd hear something and I'd squirm with pleasure, you know, listening to like a Les Paul record, which my father had, or a Django Reinhardt record, or Louis Armstrong Hot Fives, you know, this wonderful stuff that my father had in amongst the junk. You know, I was less keen at the time on the, you know, The King and I or Seven Brides or Seven Brothers. That didn't quite have the, have the same effect for me.
You recount a time when you were 11 and your sister decided to read out your school report card, specifically about your performance in music. And you write, the music master, Herr Prinz, damning me as a musical no-hoper, not to mention a disruptive and lazy so-and-so. So you clearly loved music. You just didn't particularly like this class or some sort of formal training. What was it about that kind of class, that musical class, that just didn't work for you as a kid?
I think it's because I started playing by ear rather than, you know, formally with the notes. So it confused me. I got so used to picking things up really quite quickly by ear that when it came to looking at the notes on a page, it just didn't mean anything to me. Maybe I was a bit dyslexic or something as well. So, you know, formal music lessons, it took me a long time to get through it. And it wasn't until I learned classical guitar that the teacher was a lot more patient with me and would actually sit down and explain exactly what was going on. And from that point onwards, I was able to deal with both ways of looking at music.
What kept you from quitting? Sometimes when kids get frustrated, they decide not to do something anymore.
Oh, I love music. I was never going to quit, never going to quit. But then it wasn't something that I had a sort of professional ambition about. It wasn't as if I was learning classical music to end up on the concert platform. I was really playing music because I loved it. And then I began playing in bands with my friends because I loved it. And we just thought, well, this is fun. This is great. Oh, my goodness. Look, you know, someone's offered us a recording contract. Well, it'll be fun for a couple more years. You know, that's great. But we never thought beyond a couple of years. And we probably were thinking that at some point we'd have to go back to university or get real jobs, you know. I was 40 years old and my mother was still saying, well, you know, isn't it time you settled down and got a proper job? You know, this is what, when I'm selling out the, you know, the festival hall in London.
Moms. The name of the book is Bee's Wing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975. My guest is Richard Thompson. I do want to go back to one of those first bands that you started, about 14 years old, and you write, as with many young bands, our first show was our last. What were those early performances like? How would you describe those early Richard Thompson band performances?
Well, that one, that was the beginning and end of that band. Yeah, we rehearsed for years. I mean, literally years. We probably rehearsed for 2 years. And then the gig broke us. We were, you know, assaulted. Stuff was thrown at us. We were booed. And we were clearly not ready to perform. And we were under-amplified as well. And then my next band was with a guy called Hugh Cornwell, who you may know from a band called The Stranglers. Mm-hmm. And Hugh played bass. I played guitar. Where we had another kid from school playing drums. And that was nicer. You know, we played at parties, we played at little, you know, local events, and that was a lot more successful. And we'd just be doing like R&B covers or something. So that was fun. And it wasn't until I really met up with the guys who became Fairport Convention that we really started to have a proper musical direction and a far more interesting set list.
Yeah, because of that year, that time period that's in the title, 67 to 75, a lot of it is about your time at the Fairport Convention. And you write that hippie culture and psychedelic rock was taking over as the dominant youth culture. How did that cultural shift affect your own musical sensibilities?
Well, sensibilities, not so much. We always thought that we were a bit aloof, you know, and a bit separate from psychedelia. I mean, we were not Pink Floyd. We were not the Soft Machine. We were, you know, it's kind of folk rock band that loved lyrics, you know, and we loved to jam a bit as well at the same time. So we kind of had our own particular niche. What was an advantage at that time was the fact that there was a kind of psychedelic movement, and we rode it on the wave of it. So record companies were signing lots of people. There was tons of work around. I mean, you could play 7 nights a week if you wanted to. So it's fantastic to come out, to emerge at a time like that, which was so helpful to us.
I want to play a clip. This is from a live session presented by the BBC in 1968. It's a bit of you playing on the song Autopsy. Do you remember when this was recorded?
Absolutely not.
Well, let's listen to it anyway. We can talk about it on the other side. What do you hear when you hear that?
I hear a version of the song that's not quite as good as the record. I play a much better solo on the record. It's me trying to be a bit kind of jazzy, I suppose. It's a beautiful song. It's a Sandy Denny song, and she wrote it in 3-time signatures, which sounds daunting, but actually, it's a very smooth kind of ride through these different fields, you know, musical fields. We did lots of stuff for the BBC. The BBC was wonderful in that it would take all the bands around the music scene and have them record a session, and then that would be played, you know, on BBC radio, you know, in the afternoons or in the evenings, and we all got paid, you know, we all get our, you know, £5.50 or whatever it was, you know, in the time. Not very much, but it was something. So the BBC was a wonderful and sometimes inadvertent, unknowing supporter of the music scene.
My guest is Richard Thompson. The name of his book is Bee's Wing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 75. You mentioned money. As you described, your relationship with money was a, quote, a bit abstract. How did you think about money in those early days? It's always an interesting thing to think about when someone's art is their job.
I don't know what I was thinking. Being in a band, you have a kind of support system. So you figure that somehow you're all going to eat, that there'll be enough in the pie that you can split it up. We also had a management that we're not going to let us starve, exactly. So within that bubble, I was a bit of a socialist, I suppose. I really didn't think about money. I didn't cash checks. I go for days or weeks without anything at all. I had a very, as I said, abstract relationship with money. I didn't get a bank account until I was 23, which is a bit strange, considering I was getting paid by check from the age of 18. There were lots of strange anomalies in my life at that point, lots of disconnects, really, in my life.
Huh. Tell me a little bit more about that, the disconnects. What do you mean?
I think I was so head in the clouds. I was really out there in dreamland, you know, really. A naturally induced rather than a drug-induced dreamland. So I was in my own fantasy world, in my own dream world for so much of the time. The reality really impinged upon it. And sometimes I just surfaced, but because I had to engage with that other world. But mostly I just kind of floated through life. It was a strange, strange thing.
In 1970, you stepped away from Fairport Convention to do some solo work. How were you thinking about the kind of work you wanted to do?
I think I wanted to develop as a songwriter, and not being in a band made that much easier. So I could be, you know, working for Sandy Denny, I could be working for Ian Matthews in their bands, but that gave me enough time off to be writing. And so I wrote a solo album, which I recorded, a very quirky record, I must say. And then I started working with my ex, Linda. We had a duo for 10 years, and we made 6 records, I think, altogether. And that was a whole developing process of writing as well. So that was a wonderful time for me to be flexing my writing muscles.
Did you realize at the time that that work was quirky?
I think I did, actually, yeah. I think I was eccentric, and I think I was very aware of being eccentric, and I kind of looked to other famous eccentrics around Britain as kind of kindred spirits in many ways. It's better than being boring, isn't it? Let's face it.
True. My guest is Richard Thompson. The name of his book is Bee's Wing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 75. How much of finding your voice has to do with your faith?
I think that you reflect whoever you are, whatever you believe in, whatever your morality is, all comes out in whatever you try to create. You can't help it. I hate beating people over the head with my opinions or my beliefs, and I hate it when other people do it to me. So probably in my music, it's more covert, but it's in there somewhere. It's just like a world overview that inevitably you express when you write.
Does your faith help you as a writer?
I think it helps you to avoid some things, yeah. Mm. And it gives you a kind of a connection to, you know, the universe. It shows you, if you like, your place in the universe. And, you know, the music business is a shark-infested ocean, as I'm sure you're aware. So it helps one to steer a course through the hazardous seas.
Did you enjoy writing this book?
I did. I enjoyed the initial process. I loved the anecdotes. I loved writing about old colleagues and situations and incidents. I struggled to put it all into some kind of sequence. It was hard to do that because I just didn't know when things happened. So I had to consult websites. I had to ask a few people when things happened. Being a songwriter, you know, I'm used to writing things for 3 minutes, and books take a bit longer. And also as a songwriter, but people never question you. Yeah, you can write something really obscure and possibly meaningless, and people say, "Oh, you're just a tortured genius. You must be because you know, I can't understand it." Whereas when you write a book, you have these people called editors, and the editors say, "What exactly do you mean by that?" And this came as a shock to me that I had to actually to explain what I meant. and of course, my editors were always right about everything. They taught me a lot of things.
That was my conversation with Richard Thompson about his book B-Swing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975. Richard Thompson has a few live shows scheduled for August in New York and throughout New England. For tickets and more information, visit his website. And that is all of it. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for listening, and I will meet you back here next time.